Welcome to Stocks Not Sports, the podcast where we try to talk about investment ideas in the same casual way we talk about sports with our acquaintances, work colleagues, friends, and family members. This podcast is brought to you by Infor Financial Group, who is committed to providing innovative, forward-thinking financial advice to all of their clients and customers. I'm Kenrick Sylvester, Principal and Head of Distribution. I have to note the following disclaimer. This podcast is not to be taken as investment advice, and participants or employees of Infor Financial Group may own securities discussed in this podcast. While we love all of our guests, this podcast may contain forward-looking statements, investment opinions, and comments that we do not agree with at all.
On September 15th, Nike created a revolutionary new basketball shoe. On October 18th, the NBA threw them out of the game. Fortunately, the NBA can't stop you from wearing them. Air Jordans from Nike.
With me today is Dion Walcott. Dion is principal at Yellow Brick Impact, which provides access to education through funded scholarships enabled by brand partnerships. Some of Yellow Brick's partners include Billboard, Rolling Stone, Complex, Fit, Parsons, and NYU. This initiative creates programs for brand partners to create career opportunities in underserved communities. This is a wonderful way in which a brand can pursue diversity, open a recruitment pipeline, partner with new consumers, and support local action from a cultural point of view. And the ties that bind all of this? Sneakers. Jordans, Chucks, Sambas, Shell Toes, Yeezys, Pumps, Questions, Pennies, million-dollar collaborations with designers like Virgil Abloh, Rick Owens, Supreme, and entertainers from Run-DMC to Kanye West to even Drake. Over the past 10 years, sneaker culture has really emerged socially, and the value of sneakers as an asset has exploded. From social statements to fashion statements, Dion is here to help us break it all down. Dion, man, welcome to the show.
Well, Kendrick, thank you for having me, man. That was a really, really good introduction. Super excited to get into this conversation with you. A lot of people probably don't realize we've known each other over a decade. So you've seen sneaker culture from like 10 years ago to what it is today. And it's cool to see what it's become.
It's amazing. It's amazing. So instead of taking a few minutes to tell us about your background, we'd love to do this speed dating questionnaire where we try to learn a little bit more about you in a few seconds. You ready?
For sure. Absolutely.
All right. So what high school did you attend?
Actually, a couple. Central Commerce, Central Tech, and St. Patrick's.
All right. Post-secondary education?
Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Books or podcasts?
Books.
High tops or low cuts?
Low cuts for sure.
All right. We'll talk about that later. Meal kit or order in?
Meal kit.
All right. Favorite device? Phone, tablet, or smart TV remote control?
Phone.
Makes sense. Dead stock or live stock?
That's a tough one. I'll go with dead stock.
You have to go dead stock, man.
For sure.
All right. Video games or foosball?
I want to say foosball and get some activity in there.
All right. All right. Twitter, Instagram, or LinkedIn?
Ooh, tough one. Let's say LinkedIn.
LinkedIn? Okay. Business always.
it's grown to be that. That wasn't always that.
All right. Let's go to music. I think I know the answer to this one. R&B, hip-hop, reggae, rock, pop, jazz, country, or classical?
Hip-hop.
All right, I got that. All right, now this is the hardest question, I think, given the context of this conversation. Your favorite pair of kicks?
It's actually not a hard question for me. Bo Jackson's.
All right.
First time, first time being introduced to someone who could play two sports is like a real superhero to me as a child, so...
Now, it's going to sound corny. My favorites, believe it or not, are those Air Trainer ones. Tinker Hatfield's first foray into cross-training, and the Bo Jacksons were the second version of those.
Right. So it's like, not a lot of people know that, though, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm the old guy, so that's why you got the younger version. Listen, so anyway, look, clearly we've known each other for a very long time. You spent time working with Youth Employment Services, Pathways to Education Canada, Toronto Loves Kicks, where we met, Yellow Brick Marked. Over the years, you've always found new and innovative ways to engage, educate, and empower urban youth. So I want to know what really first attracted you to this mission.
I mean, it kind of happened naturally, like out of my work with Pathways to Education. It all happened when I took some kids across the border for back to school sneaker shopping to New York. And then an aha moment happened where I was like, these kids barely would even come downtown Toronto with me. How did I get them to have trust to go all the way to New York City to go back to school sneaker shopping? Then I realized it wasn't me as much as I thought I was cool. It was the sneakers that let them take a risk or put them on an adventure. And then I really started to analyze sneakers outside of it being something that's a function and more of something that like can actually push people forward to like do things they may not want to do, i.e. speak to new people, go into new spaces, learn new things. And then from there, it kind of just, I always was interested to see how can I do more and more with something that's meant to be worn on your feet and use it as a way to empower people and communities.
Well, let's expand on that. So what were the next steps once you realized that sneakers as a culture was emerging and can help you connect with the youth? What was the next steps and the progression there?
I mean, at first it was, you know, how do I teach the teacher in a sense? Or, you know, how do I speak to the school boards and the people who are out there doing the hard work and show them that sneakers is an engagement tool and it has a language behind it that you can use to talk to the next generation. And then it grew from there where you had a lot of teachers who started to understand it. We're like, wow, okay, I can learn a little bit about, you know, the sneaker culture and use that as almost a lesson plan to engage with people, not only in high school, but like people who went to university, people who need a platform to showcase their skills. Then the next part was, how do you take what you've learned from an institutional setting and start to now find, you know, partners like the Pumas or, you know, the Rolling Stones or Finish Line or Foot Locker, and teaching them now, like, it's less about the sale and it's more about the community that's behind the people who are buying this product. And then the third part was like, how do you bring all of those things together? Which is where I feel I'm at now, where, you know, there's a really cool intersection between the business of the sneaker culture, then the culture in and of itself, where you're trying to teach people, you know, how do you explore the industry? And maybe you start with sneakers, but then you end up in fashion or you end up in music. And it's more right. just a gateway to doing many other things. And I think the way you started off the conversation earlier, it really is like something that ties into a lot of different sections in life generally. But then when you start to look at like your career and the way you may want to, you know, explore different careers, sneakers is a great entry point to think about a lot of different ways to do things.
That's interesting. Let's peel the onion a little bit. For the uninitiated, can you describe a brand activation and why companies are so keen in having the right individuals in charge of an activation for a particular product?
Yeah, no, we did. Well, a perfect example, I'll use a real one. We just did something for the Final Four underneath the Marked banner, where we allowed 50 young artists from Indianapolis to come out, and they had an hour to design all white sneakers that had a narrative. So all the art pieces were speaking to, you know, diversity and inclusion plus basketball. And that was kind of, well, not kind of, it wasn't an activation in the sense of like, A, we're now going into a community that doesn't have a platform. So we're going to activate it by giving the community an opportunity to perform on a stage. Then we're going to celebrate it and change what, you know, a brand is a marketing vessel, but it also could be a marketing vessel in a different way. And now you're promoting talent from a community. So we're splicing it. So it's not always about the sale, and it started to be about empowerment right. and awareness. And I think a lot more brands are starting to figure it out where, you know, if we can use our voice to bring attention to, you know, the creative arts or to different career opportunities, that's also our duty, because we use our voice for sales. Why don't we use our voice to help the industry grow and make it become a little bit more diverse? So an activation in and of itself is like, how do you go into different communities, activate something where now they feel like, wow, my voice was heard because of a brand? And then to the second part of your question, I think it's very important to have the right people that are part of a community to activate in the community, because otherwise it could be seen as like, you know, it's not authentic. It can't always just be process driven. there's real people doing community work from the community, and that's part of it. You know, the artists are one part.
That's fascinating, man. Let's step back on just sneaker demand as a whole. So for those not in the culture, most people view sneakers as a necessity rather than really a way of life. But either way, sneakers is big business, right? So with 2020 footwear sales of over $23 billion, Nike's still number one in the global footwear market. Adidas number two, just under 14. Puma three, Under Armour four. So generally, we all understand the trends towards a more healthy lifestyle. But why is sneakers still such a big business?
I mean, I think, you know, if you really look at it, just the core of what it's all about is it's an expression of who you are, right? Like everyone has a pair of sneakers, whether it's to go to the gym or to look cool or to walk up the street. Now that the, you know, I shouldn't say the world, but globally, it's become a phenomenon where it's the stories that are behind the sneakers that people wear that's really exploding. You know, it's getting into to the luxury market now. And it's really a storytelling element that's driving this sneaker thing. You know, shouldn't even call it a sneaker thing, but the sneaker culture, it's really built on an expression of oneself, because what you wear on your feet, someone looks down and say, oh, okay, so you're wearing Jordan 1s? Okay, I kind of understand the type of person you are. Then there's the next side of it where it's like the storytelling element and how humans are using it to break barriers and how they're connecting because of the stories that are told by what's on their feet. And I think that that's never ending, because there's so much stories that people can tell when it comes to sneakers. And of course, you know, the athletic side, and now falling into the community side, it's just, it's limitless the amount of things that the sneaker industry and the sneaker culture can get into.
It's amazing. I know we already touched on it earlier. I mean, you're resonating with Bo Jackson, me falling in love with those Air Trainer Ones by Tinker Hatfield. I mean, there are stories behind some of the sneakers that you wish you had and that have an opportunity to buy now, and the ones that you did have as a kid, and you just want to recreate that feeling. So I definitely identify with that. And then you did touch on something here with the high fashion houses. Around 10 years ago, I think, they really tried to crash the sneaker party, right? So you got, excluding those Gucci tennis shoes from 84, that I don't know if a lot of people remember those, but pick a fashion house like Louis Vuitton, Gucci, Prada, Yves Saint Laurent, Balenciaga. They all came to market with these $1,000 sneakers looking to cash in on the wave of buying. For obvious reasons, a true sneakerhead, you know, not really that interested. But why, in your opinion, would a Kicks lover pass on a $1,000 pair of Valentinos and buy a $1,000 pair of dead stock OG Jordan 1s on StockX?
Oh, I mean, that's there's a lot of reasons that I think the game has changed so much in that 10 years ago, there wasn't a StockX. You know, stock, for those who don't know, like StockX is like, you know, the stock market of sneakers. So people are putting value to these items now. It's not so much even a fashionable thing to wear. It's actually an investment, right? So it's like, okay, I can go buy a pair of Louis Vuittons, cool, and they look cool. But like people are now, you know, investing in sneakers because like I could wear these once or buy two pair and have it on a shelf, and I paid $1,000 and they may be worth $10,000 in 30, 40 days. So I think that's an element side of it where it's like there's an investment side where it's become kind of a sneaker stock market. Then I also think what people really overlook is just the generational time, how it's changed, where you are 70 and your grandchildren now are like, hey, I want to get a pair of Jordans. You're forced to actually listen to what they're talking about because you want to be cool with your kids. And you put that into the business world, it kind of goes down the hill. So now you're forced to make changes in the space. And then, you know, next thing you know, it's a whole luxury market. There's just a ton of demand for cool stuff now.
Funny, StockX, I know we both alluded to it here, but I'm sure you saw the numbers. Yesterday, they announced a new round of financing, $225 million they raised at a valuation of $3.8
billion. Yeah, and also remember, StockX has grown, you know, not only to have sneakers, they also have a whole bunch of luxury goods that they're reselling now. So, but that's just a sign to show you like collectible items that are fashionable are now becoming a real thing from the investment standpoint.
100%. I mean, they reported revenues of $400 million, up from $239 million in 2019. I mean, the business is exploding.
Yeah. I mean, I had an opportunity to check out their warehouse or their HQ in Detroit. And it's just, it's amazing to see what they've built from the ground up.
So do they have, how does it work? So I know they have authenticators on staff. Is it, you know, the shoes come through, you have to have them authenticated, then they just ship them off. How does the business work, soup to nuts?
It's almost, and they probably wouldn't like that I called it this, but it's FedEx-like, where it's like a truck drops off a whole bunch of packages, which are the sneakers that, say, Kendrick sent in. It goes through a sorting process of seeing if they're real, if they're fake, if they're in good condition. Then from there, it goes to getting shot so you can put it on StockX. And then literally, it's just a matter of time before someone buys them and it goes back out the door. Then there's the good and then there's the bad. So, oh, these are fakes. Okay, they're going to this side. These aren't fakes. They're going through the whole system. And it just loops like that all day long. It's like no different than working at, you know, a factory that on the line.
Amazing. It's also amazing that Dan Gilbert, the CEO of Quicken Loans, or I guess Jeremy is now, he's one of the founders of the business. So anyway, he was smart.
He's smart. And I think, you know, like the piece that people don't get to see, while, you know, I give him his a lot of credit, is the amount of employment that Dan Gilbert has created for Detroit. Detroit is a line city, right? Like, you know, GM, mm-hmm. you know, like they're used to that type of work. So if you really look, pay attention to it real closely, StockX is now become the new GM of Detroit. Those same people who got laid off are now working for StockX, the new generation, right? Like your son that, you know, your father got laid off and you didn't know what you're going to do for your son. Your son's now working at StockX and they have a pretty good life, where it's just like, wow, like he's seen a void in the Detroit culture and then he built a sneaker business around it. And then, you know, now it's become like, you know, like you just said, a billion-dollar industry.
So if we were to talk, again, just keep on the sneaker culture theme. For me, if we were going to encapsulate sneaker culture or sneakerheads and how they think, one phenomenon I still find amazing is that kids who've never seen Michael Jordan play line up for hours, obviously pre-COVID, to buy a version of his sneakers. Last year, Nike announced that brand Jordan alone had $3.6 billion in revenues, which outsold Puma, Asics, and Under Armour. So why the love of Jordans? Is it branding? Is it status? How do the youth you interact with think about it?
I mean, I think you have to give credit to just Jordan, the athlete and the individual. Like, I don't think we've ever seen anyone do what Jordan's done. What a lot of people don't realize, once Jordan separated himself from Nike and became his own brand that Nike just produces, there's not many other brands that any other individuals that have that deal. Once Jordan was able to kind of curate his own brand and tell the Jordan stories over and over and over again, it's almost like it'll never be erased, because generationally just keeps getting passed down over and over and over again. A lot of that, like LeBron James is still a Nike athlete. He has LeBron James sneakers and his own line, his own building, but that's Nike. It's not LeBron James' own brand in and of itself. And I think because he was able to do that, that's why he'll never, you know, he'll never be an old, never become old. He'll just be like, I can tell the same story over and over again with complete control.
And interestingly enough, I know, you know, The Last Dance comes out, and Jordans were killing it to begin with, and now they've seen this massive resurgence. It's just the gift that keeps on giving, man.
So, well, what he did there was you know, was genius. Not only did he take care of his buddies he played with and made them relevant again, but like he reminded people of his legacy, and like it's almost like if he did that every 5 years, like it's even, you'll never get rid of Jordan.
My brother's not going to like that. He's a John Starks fan. He wants Jordan to go away.
It's okay. But see, even in that, it's like you could be a John Starks fan, but that's a story, and Jordan will tell that story and sell millions of sneakers.
Yeah, that's true. Interesting. So Run DMC used to wear their Adidas with no laces. Again, I'm showing my age here. At the time, it was controversial because that's how they wore them in prison, right? You take the laces out for safety. What's one of the more unique sneaker subculture trends that you've actually observed today?
I want to say, you know, the art on sneakers, like people customizing. And, you know, like I said, we just got back from Indianapolis and we did a marked activation out there, and seeing how much people can be creative on a sneaker. And I think that's a culture in and of itself, because you don't necessarily need to even know who Jordan is. you just see an all-white pair of sneakers and you have an artistic talent, and that becomes a sub-community in and of itself, compliments of a white sneaker, right? So it's like, you know what I mean? Like, there was mothers there who could care less about who Jordan was. They just seen like, oh, wow, because of this sneaker, I was able to meet 100 people today. That's one of the cultures, that the subcultures, I should say, that makes me excited, because I just feel like there's such a span of different ages and people and diversity in that space that it should be supported more, because the arts in and of itself don't get to shine usually from like someone who, think about when in high school, it's like the class that only certain people took our class and wasn't celebrated. Athletes were celebrated, you know, like we just talked about Michael Jordan. Like, we don't celebrate Tinker Hatfield in the same way. I feel like that's the subculture that I'm starting to get really, really attracted to, and trying to figure out, like, how do we start to build more platforms for that subculture of the DIY, and, you know, giving artists an opportunity to showcase their skills. So I think that's probably the next subculture that I think that sneaker culture and sneaker industry can help to develop even more.
Interesting. I think I hit you. I saw a pair of Air Force Ones that had been designed by an artist go for a big number on Sotheby's. And then last May, Sotheby's announced that Michael Jordan's game-worn autographed Air Jordan 1s from 85 sold for $560,000 US in an online auction. Like, it's insane.
It's crazy.
Yeah, so let's go back to resale here. So in 2014, the sneaker resale market hit $1 billion. In 2019, it grew to about 6. And fast forward, the analysts now think that the sneaker resale market could hit $30 billion by 2030. So the crazy question is, are sneakers really becoming collectibles like artwork? Or is this just another example of too much money out there chasing too few assets?
I think they're going to become a real collectible. Like I said, it's the stories that people are buying. Like, there's no difference between, you know, a piece of expensive art that you would buy to put on your wall and a pair of sneakers that are super rare. I think there's another element of it. It's like, there's just a lot of money in that space, but I think you're going to start seeing more and more of like limited edition sneakers that have, you know, an artist attached to it. It's less about what the actual, you know, the form of the sneaker is and what the sneaker stands for is going to become the art piece of it, where it's like, you know, I just did something with Adidas. There's something called the Seed Program, where it's like they paid, I think it was 6 young women to go through an internship program where none of them had any experience inside of the sneaker industry. They taught them for a year. They created a shell toe. And that shell toe sneaker represents like women getting into the industry, a new form of education. And then the piece that they created, like that's valuable because it's a story and that's a piece of art now, right? So I think you're going to see more and more of those things happening. That's why I think, you know, it's more of a collectible and storytelling, and more less of like, okay, well, there's a lot of money in the space. But obviously there's money in this space, but I think it's going to be more of a collectible item situation.
Let's talk about sneakers gone bad, for lack of a better phrase. I mean, the rarity, the collectability of them, I know we all appreciate that. But there is a bit of a, let's say, an underbelly that we don't really appreciate or really want. So for those who don't know, there was a Nike executive who had to resign from Nike after 25 years because her son used her corporate credit card to purchase $102,000 worth of limited edition sneakers for resale. So, you know, that's bad enough. He also used a bot to buy 600 pairs of Adidas. Again, so cornering the market, preventing people from buying them, and then reselling them at a profit. I mean, the question to you, like, how do you feel about that, and how do the companies get around stuff like this?
I mean, yeah, I mean, it's like I said, like, it's an industry, right? Like, there's the good and the bad. Like, I mean, I feel like I don't know how you're going to block that outside of like closing those company stores, but there's no difference between that kid and the kid who's hustling on the street to figure out how to go get it. What people don't speak about was the corporate card because she worked there. But what if she didn't work there? Like, there's a kid doing that right now. So no one slaps that person's hand. It's just part of the game. Like, it's now changed the whole way the sneaker industry's working. They can't get rid of it. Otherwise, the game completely changes and it hurts sales. So like, you need the one to lead the other, I feel like. To me, it's less about what he did and more about how he did it was the wrong thing.
Yeah, fair enough. And I think it was kind of, it did make me laugh, you know, no disrespect to anybody, but it was a Nike corporate card to buy Adidas shoes. So I had to laugh at that, to be honest. You get pinched. Let's talk a little bit more about sneaker design. So I know we both talked about Tinker Hatfield. For those that don't know, Phil Knight hired an architect to design sneakers for Nike in 81. That was Tinker Hatfield. He realized that his architectural skills could be applied to shoes and started designing shoes for Jordan. So he started with the Air Jordan 3, and the rest is history. Actually, Phil Knight credits the Air Jordan 3 for saving Nike because Michael Jordan was thinking about going to Adidas at the time. So most people understand sneaker design, but I don't think a lot of people really understand a lot of the things you've alluded to, all the different career opportunities within these big sneaker design companies and athletic shoe entities. So the title of Director of Strategic Fashion or VP of Brand Partnerships, what are some employment opportunities or careers within big companies that people just don't really know about?
In relation to sneakers, I feel like, you know, there's a 3D designer. So, you know, like a 3D designer is going to take a designer's concept and turn it into a 3D piece that you can now show the designer and they can, you know, scrape it up and make it look better based on something that's kind of looked real. Then there's something, you know, there's something called a CTC, which is like a concept to creation. So it's like, now I'm the person who's going to come up with a concept and how we're going to bring it to creation. That's more on the marketing side. Then there's the PMs, so like the project managers of the whole game, where it's like Tinker Hatfield came up with a sneaker. Who's going to now take that product and manage it all the way through to how it gets on the Foot Locker shelf? That's a very specific way of thinking. You're still involved with the sneaker industry. You're still involved with the designer. And you actually probably hold more weight because, like, yeah, if Tinker Hatfield's sexy sneaker is amazing, but if you didn't have someone who could help you bring it to market, then it would still be just in the Nike headquarters doing nothing. I look at it, it's like very much of a sport where it's like the designer usually is your biggest scorer. Then you have the CTCs, the PMs, the marketing people all around that one person. And that team has to move together. There's a joke, you know, a good buddy of mine, Dwayne Edwards, who used to work for Jordan Brand. He always says, no one wants to be a rebounder anymore. Everyone wants to be the designer. Which meaning like you can have a really, really good career supporting the person who has to score the ball, which is usually the designer.
Right, right. That's a great analogy. Just to keep trying to hit the point home, I think, I'm sure you saw that Adidas signed Fear of God's Jerry Lorenzo away from Nike. So that was a big coup. But a surprising stat is the fact that after reaching a decade high peak of $1.3 billion in 2015, sales of non-retro, so non-retro basketball shoes, have been a complete free fall. So generated about $800 million in sales in 2019 and only $640 million in 2020. So just to say it again, on-court performance basketball shoes represent only 3% of sneaker market sales in 2020. So I think this is a realization, and correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of these companies are really starting to realize that sneakerheads mean much more to their bottom line than they did 6 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. And the truth is, like, there's only so many players that play professional sports. There's way more normal people doing extraordinary things in the world that can design sneakers or influence the sneaker industry than there ever be the 500 LeBron Jameses. Right. So that when you look at Jerry Lorenzo, it's like, of course, he probably has a larger voice in some sense because he looks like the normal guy that's creative that made it. You have to, you know, strict diet and do this and do that to be LeBron James. I'd rather, not me personally, but there's a lot of people who would rather support the creative person because, you know, they're a normal person. And then if you scale that, all of a sudden, like, there's a lot more of those people to go around. Like, Snoop has a deal with, you know, Snoop Dogg has a deal with Adidas. Like, and you see that, oh, Snoop Dogg, wow, cool. But, like, he moves units. He's not LeBron James, not in the gym. You know, he doesn't have commercials, but like at the end of the day, it hits the consumer a lot differently.
Yeah, exactly. So listen, I want to focus on you for a little bit. You are unique in that you've used your educational background and personal experience with youth to truly build an understanding of urban culture and really leverage that understanding to help build successful brand partnerships. So from where I sit, you're a real urban culture consultant who specializes in positioning or actually repositioning brands for specific target audiences. And I mean, that's basically a fancy way of saying you know, to communicate and resonate with inner city youth. And this is not a small feat. So I want to hear a little bit more about your education and youth initiatives at Yellow Brick.
I appreciate that great intro. Yellow Brick, it's a startup company that delivers or gives people opportunity to explore passion industries, one being the sneaker industry. People take our courses and, you know, they get a certificate at the end. What we've done a really good job at is partnering with top tier universities like Parsons and FIT, but then also partnering with top tier industry leaders like Complex and Rolling Stone. And the idea there is like bringing those two together, a blended education where you're getting academia, but you're also getting industry. Yellow Brick is the team that puts it together and mashes it up and makes it a curriculum that people can now dive into. You know, we have a lot of different courses from sneakers to streetwear to music to fashion. Then recently, you know, I was able to talk to Rob Kingjins, who's our CEO, and we started a brand new department, which is called Yellow Brick Impact. And what we've realized over the last 5 years, or I should say over the last 3 years since I've joined the company, is that because of the type of courses that we offer, we attract a lot of people from underserved and underrepresented communities. And usually what happens to them is their biggest barrier of taking these courses is affordability. You know, now you're staying at home, it highlights even more that you don't have $1,000 to pay for a course. And a lot of these brands came out with these, you know, really strong statements about wanting to support communities that may not have access and awareness. So, you know, I went to the lab again and created Yellow Brick Impact. And the whole idea now is, how do we speak to individuals, corporations, and brands to fund scholarships for people who may not be able to afford it? And then on the other side of that is like, now once they get a funded scholarship, how do we also design extension programs for them to apply what they learn so it becomes more practical? It's not like I'm walking around with a piece of paper saying, I got my certificate. You know, I'm putting a lot of pressure on brands to say, you guys are actually the teachers, because if you're a designer, if you're a CTC that works at a particular brand, you're actually in a position to do a couple of things. Share your career journey, because a lot of people who come from underserved communities don't realize how you got to where you got to. A lot of the times when you get there, you didn't plan to get there that way. Like I use myself as an example, like from social work to working at a museum to starting a boutique consultancy / agency, to working with all these, you know, Fortune 500 brands, and then now being at Yellow Brick, my guidance counselor in high school couldn't have told me that journey, right? So the more that brands can take the responsibility of telling how the people in their building got to those positions, that's one, because that gives them awareness. And the second piece is like, now let's develop curriculum and courses that people can touch the product, which is what I call more of an extension program. Now you're going to give your industry or inside tips to a community that would never have access to those. So what we're doing right now with, you know, shout out to Reebok, you know, Reebok recently put together the structure where we're funding 50 scholarships targeted at underserved communities. They go through an 8-week curriculum that's a blended program of Yellow Brick's curriculum and people from Reebok in and of itself. So like you're meeting people who are real designers, people who are real CTCs that are working for the brand. And then at the end of it, these 50 people who got a scholarship are now going to present in front of a Reebok team to create a product. So like, if you really look at it, of the cycle of it or the journey of it, is like, we educated them, we gave them access to like real talent and mentorship from inside of a brand. Then we're actually going to make a product. We're going to sell that product, and the sales of that product is now going to go back into the sustainability of doing this again for another community. And that's what the whole Yellow Brick Impact is all about, not only just for sneakers, but for all of our different verticals that we offer. So it's a mashup of all my skills. And I think the biggest thing we're looking for now is the support from the brands, the individuals, and the corporations, so we can scale this and impact more communities. Because there's just so much more work that we need to get done.
That's amazing, man. Congratulations. That is truly, truly amazing. I want to delve into the concept of sneaker art. We've touched on it a little bit. First, congratulations on making Foot Locker's The Soul List, which honors the next generation of Black innovators who are helping shaping the future of sneaker culture, man. So hats off to you. It's well-deserved, and I'm sure there are more accolades coming in the future. I love your quote, drawing in the dark, no one knows you're creative. I think that's amazing. How has your marked initiative given sneaker artists a new forum to display their talents?
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly what you just said. Like, you know, there's a couple of things I said, but exactly what you just said. Like, there's a lot of artists that aren't celebrated. There's no platform to celebrate them. You know, if you're an artist, you're typically drawing in the dark because no one knows you have that talent. And now that what Mark does is we've created a platform to put you in the light so you can be celebrated. Like, you know, we just did in Indianapolis. It's like we had everyone from the age of like 21 to 52 being like, Dion, your team is amazing. Your Pattern team is amazing, which is a local magazine in Indianapolis. Without this, I never had an opportunity to display my skills publicly. A lot of people said this, like when I go back into high school, it was more like, yeah, art class, they celebrate it in your classroom, but like it doesn't overflow into society. One of the guys said this weekend, what I thought was interesting is the first thing that got cut was arts during COVID. He said the way that they presented what the plan was for COVID, the COVID relief, was you had to hire an artist to create that graphic. And it was just like, it was real interesting because you're like, wow, like as much as you're saying cut it, you need arts and culture in society in order to have certain messages. And, you know, the next level of it is how can we now scale it so it becomes more of like we can come to Mark and look for talent and we can help creative talent get placed and start their career.
It's interesting. You know, when we spoke about Mark in the past, just for the uninitiated, again, soup to nuts, how it works. I really loved your basketball analogy. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, I mean, it's the basketball analogy. Look at it from the sense of like, let me take it back. There was a statement that I said, we need to celebrate artists the same way we celebrate athletes. When you look at a basketball team, they're celebrated all the time. Like just look at a high school student. Yeah. And, you know, you scored 20 last night. Wow, oh man, you the man or you the girl or whatever that sounds like. But like someone who could draw in 20 minutes in front of like 300 people, when do they get an opportunity to get that type of attention, to get that type of confidence, to be recognized? Probably not. So when you start to put a team of people together or a platform or a space, it really replicates to me basketball where it's like you have people who have different skills, but as long as you can create a platform for them to be celebrated, they kind of are the same thing as athletes in that they have to practice their skill. They have to show up in front of a crowd. So like, I always use that analogy for myself as like, there's no real difference. It's just that you're applying your skill in a different way, but the same principles could be applied to creative people.
Yeah. And it's almost like you've got an all-star basketball team that travels together and you're playing in a tournament and a bunch of new people are watching you. And then you go to another locale and other people are watching you and it's more crowds and bigger scouts. And it seems like that progression and you're providing that opportunity for young people in the art world.
And not only young people. I think that, you know, young is relative, but.
Well, everybody's young compared to me. So for those who don't know, Dion helped put together a history of sneakers exhibit called Out of the Box, The Rise of Sneaker Culture at the Bada Shoe Museum on Bloor Street here in Toronto back in 2014. So the exhibit went on to other museums and cities, including Brooklyn, Atlanta, Louisville, Oakland, and even Perth, Australia. So again, I'm curious, what was that experience like?
I want to say for myself, that was like my first MBA after university. And why I say that is because, you know, museums is a very elite culture. And to bring in sneakers, which is what they are currently, was a grassroots culture. And for them to meet or try to meet in the middle to tell that story from where it started to where it is, what people didn't realize was that you're actually blending two cultures together that typically would not be in the same room. So living through that was super empowering because here's Dion, a kid from a low income area. Now I'm going into a space that's super elite. and they that you play by different rules there. I'm the sneaker guy, and I'm super excited to do this job, but then the job in and of itself comes with different principles and how you can move around a building when it comes to artifacts. Like, when you really think about a sneaker at that time, like, sneakers were now becoming something that you can look into as like, if I put this inside a museum, A, is it real? Is it really an artifact? Then there's the business of it. Well, can we make it an artifact so it drives people to museums? Because the museum culture is dying. So, like, it was a real cool experience to understand, wow, like, the sneaker is about to become a really cool artifact and a piece of history. Because, like, once it becomes in a museum, like you said, went to all these different museums, that was kind of like confirming that sneaker culture is now part of history, which is amazing. The other side of it, what people didn't get to understand, is from the ground to getting it to inside of a museum and all of that red tape. I think there's just a lot of stories there that people don't realize, that like getting it from the ground to be into museums, that museums now are looking to welcome that culture in their building. I think that's a whole story in and of itself that like should be told, but not a lot of people realize like how hard and how much work went into making that happen.
I still laugh. I know we spoke about this. I hadn't been in the Bada Shoe Museum at all, by the way, until I went to see this exhibit. But I can only imagine a conversation between Dion Walcott and a museum curator saying, you want to do what? Like, how was that initial conversation, man?
Yeah, I mean, you know what? The truth is, it was like Elizabeth, you know, the senior curator, she was interested in sneakers as it is. It's very easy to have interest in sneakers. It's now you got to understand the culture that comes with it. I think that's where some of the interesting conversations came. You know, like, yeah, artifacts is cool, but like, if you want to showcase Clark Kent's sneaker in a museum, that's amazing, typically, right? But Clark Kent's sneaker being a museum in the Bada Shoe Museum means that there's a certain community of people that are now going to be inside of your space that you've never had to interact with before because of one article, right? So like, those were the discussions that sometimes was interesting, because it's like, you know, to be honest, Dion, we're not familiar with this community that's now going to be coming to our space on a daily basis, right? And I think that, you know, that conversation was, that was where the learning was. And I'm super grateful for that, because I was literally part of the tanning, if you want to call it, the tanning of America, or the shifting in a culture where you're like seeing something that to us, like, I grew up, I never thought about ever doing anything, like you said, ever doing anything in the museum, right?
Absolutely.
Now it's like people go to the museum like it's a normal thing. Contemporary culture is being showcased at museums all the time, because they're starting to blend the two together. The halo effect of that, to me, is what's really, really cool outside of, like, obviously the sneakers itself. But, like, I can only imagine, you know, I have friends that work at the Brooklyn Museum because of that sneaker exhibit. Just how it's changed the industry. It changed the industry because two industries were forced to merge together.
I appreciate you, man. I think it was great. And also, the Bada Shoe Museum should be celebrated as well for thinking about it and actually doing it and taking it on. And I thought it was a huge success and I enjoyed it. So congratulations to everyone involved in that venture. Obviously, we talked about you've been very successful. I'm a big fan of yours, clearly. Let's talk a little bit about career adversity. So what was your get them off the field moment? You know, the moment you made a big mistake and everyone wants you to shoulder the blame. What was your moment and how did you recover?
You know, going into, I shouldn't say, let's use OCAD. OCAD was, you know, shout out to all my guys at OCAD because they took the risk. Pitching OCAD to do an Art on Sneaker tournament for high school students to drive traffic for them to come, similar to a basketball tournament. And doing it the first day and everything hit the fan because no one knew what the hell it was all about. And you had to take that whole loss on your head. Because, like, yeah, there's sneakers, there's markers, but, like, what are all these students actually doing here? The experience was terrible, but it wasn't as terrible as I thought, but it was terrible because we didn't execute it right. that was one of the hardest, because like you see this amazing vision in your mind, you go to execute it, then you run into people who don't see it outside of the box, put a lot of barriers in place, and you almost got to keep your head down while everyone has pointing the finger at you because, hey, this wasn't the way it was supposed to be, or hey, why are we doing this? Why are we doing that? And then how you recover really is like you go back to the person who invested in you in the beginning. And they were so open. We're like, yeah, you know what? I'm so happy that it did mess up because now we have something to clean up. And I remember, you know, shout out to Sean. Sean saying to me, like, Sean works at OCAD, Sean Baker. He said, because we messed up, now we have an opportunity to actually build it the right way. But like, you know how many ideas die because they never actually get messed up, right? Like, you know, you're so caution that you never actually do it. The fact that we did it, and we had something to clean up. Look what it's become now.
Thanks, man. Thanks for sharing that. So for me, listen, we could talk for hours. And ultimately, I mean, I've learned a lot given, you know, what's going on with sneaker culture, how big it is in terms of dollars and cents as a business, but how big it is in terms of career opportunities for young people and older people alike, and what you guys are doing to help facilitate that. How should potential investors or partners think about your initiatives at Yellow Brick and Marked?
Well, I mean, let's have conversations about it and look at it as like, you're not really investing in Yellow Brick and Marked. You're investing into communities, and Yellow Brick and Marked are going to help you to make a change in particular communities you may want to have supported. Use Marked and use Yellow Brick as a vessel to actually have an impact in communities that, you know, need the help. We're the stage. We're going to do a lot of the heavy lifting. We have the shiny things. What we really need is the support. We need investment so we can help more communities and we can scale these opportunities more. So I think the best way for people to look at how do you approach Yellow Brick is like, or Marked, is look at it as what you would be doing is providing a lot of people access to education, access to career opportunities. And then for on the art side, like, think about just helping people who don't think they have a chance with their creative talent to showcase their skills.
That's amazing. Amen, man. Appreciate that. We appreciate you. I do have one final question. If you could own and run a sports organization, which one would it be and why?
I think I would love to own a WNBA team. I think that, you know, for a long time, the men have been celebrated. And I just think that, you know, women, that sport is so exciting. If it was put work, there's a lot more energy that was brought to it, a lot more opportunities that was brought to it. I think it could become something super special. And then I just believe like it's a great way to integrate what's happening now, meaning like the NBA is always going to be great, but like how do you now integrate the two so it becomes more of a Voltron and less of like separated? Like, here's the WNBA and here's the NBA. I would love to be part of having an organization that figures out how do we get both leagues to be at the top of the mountain together. I think that would be super exciting.
That is interesting. And obviously, WNBA viewership has picked up. I mean, I haven't seen the numbers yet, but there was talk that this NCAA tournament, the numbers were, I mean, obviously we had 1 year without March Madness, so... But the women's game, which I watched, I thought was amazing. And congratulations to Alyssa Jerome from Toronto, who won a national championship at Stanford. But the numbers are all trending in the right direction, and that totally makes sense. And I agree.
Yeah,
with
I just
you.
Think the women, you know, like that game is just, it's, you know, when I was in college, the women's team won, and I had a firsthand experience to see, you know, how skilled and how exciting it can be. I think with just putting more energy and more support behind it, it'd be interesting to see, you know, in our lifetime. The WNBA and the NBA being on par.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me ask you this question. Given your interaction, I mean, we're talking about sneaker culture, we're talking about inner city youth, the discussion about NCAA paying players, it's a bit off topic, but what are your thoughts on that subject?
I think that, you know, I have a little bit of a different angle. Paying them would, like, I think they should get paid. If and what does that look like? I feel like that's a whole other ballgame that I don't think people really understand what that really means. Cause it's like, if they're going to get paid, they're not going to get paid as much as the school is really making, right? Cause like the amount of money that the school is making is like it's a player, even if you're in college, it's going to be a fraction, if that. I think that the same way that you have strength and conditioning programs for your athletes, you now need to have programs that are mirrored around your strength and conditioning to set them up for financial success. The same way you have to go pump iron and get your six pack in shape and get your vertical high is like, okay, what are your other interests? Every Thursday, we're going to teach you how to write a business plan, and we're going to show you how to make money while you play. That's the trick. Like, even, you know, like I do it, like, you know, I had the opportunity to work with the NBA. It's like, there's a good friend of mine, John Harris, who works for, there's a company called Athlife, and he's built a whole business around helping athletes after they finish playing. And I think it's so interesting because he says this to me all the time, is that what you don't realize is someone who makes the NBA, that's their first job ever. And you did your first job for a minimum of 5 to 6 years. And your job did not require you to have any other soft skill besides staying in shape and going to the gym. So in reality, if you're an athlete, the MBA in college almost setting you up to fail. So like now you have a millionaire who doesn't know how to write a resume, who's never been on an interview, who has no idea what entrepreneurship means. To me, like that's the system. It's less about how do we put money in their hand, but how do we start to produce strong human beings that can also walk around in the world with a different badge, like, oh, yeah, I took this entrepreneurship class when I played. Like, the schools can put those type of programs in place.
That is interesting. I know when we look at it, and again, I looked at it, that's a very interesting take, and I agree with you 100%. You look at it, and I'm going to spit some numbers at you here. I'm sure you've heard this before. But in 2019, total athletics revenue among all the NCAA athletics departments was $18.9 billion. Like, the numbers are they're staggering. And dating myself, of course, but big fan of the Fab Five, saw the documentary back in 2011. But I remember at the time, Jalen Rose, who was my favorite player, was just talking about like life as a university student, watching people wear his jersey. It's sold for $49.99 at Foot Locker, and he's eating Kraft dinner. And so when they won the national championship in 89, this is not the Fab Five, this is the Glenn Rice team, Ramil Robinson, the school grossed just over $1 million. When the Fab Five was there, they didn't win it. They won the Big Ten, and they obviously made the Final Four. That number went to $10 million. And to your point, it's almost like, and Chris Bosh just wrote, he actually just wrote something in the Players Tribune talking about how bad it was as a struggle. And this is going to sound crazy, obviously, because he's a multimillionaire now. But not having $5, not being able to get a meal outside the meal plan.
Like, you're set up to lose. And it's like entrepreneurship is a thing. And, you know, it's become a career in a sense. When you start to really think about it, like, you know, you want to pay players, cool. But is there a way that like that team that played this year gets 1% of the sales, and then it gets divvied up between all of the players? Like, these are the things that I'd rather have the conversations about, because they're not teaching young people to think like that. Give them $40,000 for the year, cool. So that's not money. Like, if you made $1 billion and you gave up 1% of the $1 billion to the players that played that year because they helped, you're not paying them now, but you're paying them. You know, like, maybe you have to apply for it. I don't know, but these are the things that I think we need to have more conversations about, because it's not always, we'll just give them money and they'll be okay.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, whether or not it's a stipend or it's some kind of payment schedule. Another great story from Bosch was when they were off campus and the buses stopped running. I'm not sure if you saw this. I think it was in the Players Tribune as well, where him and, if you remember Jarrett Jack, they didn't have enough money to get a cab.
Yeah, it's crazy. It is crazy.
So I don't fault these guys. They make these million-dollar contracts and they want to buy cars and chains and big houses. Like, you can't really fault them for wanting to do that if they don't have the financial education to go along with it.
Yeah, you can't be mad at them. I think my biggest to say to close it out is like, I think we shouldn't just focus on should we pay them. It's like, how else can we set up these players to benefit from what the school is doing outside of just giving them a payment? You blind people by saying you're just going to pay them. Here, man, I give you $100,000. Okay, but if you're willing to give me $100,000, like, how much money are you making? Right? Like, hold on a second. Like, let's think about this. You know what I mean? Like, we're diving on the floor for you.
Listen, thanks for that. And again, we could go on for hours, but listen, Dion, thank you so much for being on our podcast, man. We are very excited for you and the future of Yellow Brick and Marked. Please keep up the good work and the promotion of underappreciated and unrecognized talent in the community through sneaker culture, man. God bless you.
No, for sure. And I appreciate it, man. Thank you for having me on anytime you need it.
Thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed the podcast, check your app now to make sure that you've subscribed so that you don't miss an episode. I'm Kendrick Sylvester, and I'll see you next time. Problems and personal issues, stories that'll make your eyes tear and wet tissue. It's true, I'm mad like the rapper. I'm so upset I gotta put it up in my rap before I snap or after. The things I've seen from Atlanta to Queens to the mean streets of Brooklyn when I was a teen. Back and forth to the islands, screamed when I left, but adapted. And still my dreams haven't left. I only hung with the crack kids, weaned out the rest. Me and the roughest roughnecks went chest to chest. Now my best friend's locked up north, I won't rest till I let him live his dream through me. And I confess that even though both our hearts was dark, his was darker.